quick before the podcast starts. Take 90 seconds to help pay for it. Public Media is funded by the public. Contribute at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Donald Trump may hate the media, but LA Times editor and ISU graduate Jim Kirk says he's certainly been good for business.
The question is, does it go beyond this presidency, right? I mean, does the momentum continue after he's out of office? We'd like to think so, just because of some of the things that we're seeing.
Mike McCurdy talks with Kirk about newspapers today and their future. Plus, harken back to the words of legendary NPR broadcaster Carl Kasell. Kasell has passed away at age 84. We have a 2009 interview with him and GLT's Willis Kern. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Shortly before being named to the Vedette Hall of Fame, Jim Kirk was named as editor-in-chief for the Los Angeles Times. Kirk is a former reporter for the Illinois State University newspaper and a 1987 ISU graduate. He is now leading the newsroom for the nation's fourth largest newspaper. He has a monumental task before him, unifying a recently unionized newsroom and helping the paper grow under ownership as it moves past former management controversies and sexual harassment claims against the CEO and publisher. And the problems come at a time when all newspapers are facing pressure from declining advertising revenue as the transition to a greater digital presence continues. Despite everything, Kirk tells GLT's Mike McCurdy, the Los Angeles Times is doing well, thanks in part to the Trump era.
Still very profitable, facing, you know, the same headwinds as everybody else in terms of declining print revenue, and we're seeing the stagnant kind of digital advertising growth. You know, the real opportunity is you've seen at the Washington Post and the New York Times, and it holds true for the LA Times, is really in digital subscription growth. I mean, we're seeing much more willingness on the part of readers, especially in this era, the Trump era, who are really willing to pay for good content, and that's really that's been the focus since I've been on at the LA Times and going forward.
How has the Trump administration helped the LA Times, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and other news gathering organizations?
Well, I think you've seen it pretty clearly. You know, the New York Times in their public filings. You know, the digital subscription growth at the New York Times has been incredibly dramatic over the past several months, and a lot of that due to what's happening in Washington. And, you know, it is certainly not the panacea, but it continues to see growth. Now, for L.A. and California in general, you know, the president has really pretty much had a bullseye in a lot of things that are very important to the readership of the Los Angeles Times. You know, he's targeted immigration. He's targeted climate change and environmental issues, which are extremely important to Californians. Anytime that he takes takes aim at those issues, we see a spike in readership.
Yeah, so it's not really how the LA Times is positioned in Washington, D.C. and covering things happening inside the Beltway. It's about the issues that are important to California that are being affected by the policies in Washington.
Exactly. And, you know, we did a series of editorials. Actually, the predecessor of mine at the LA Times smartly, kind of collected, the editorial page stance of the LA Times has been pretty strong in terms of its condemnation of Trump's policies. And so we put together a package really online called this Dishonest President. And it has an extremely long tail. You know, we see the traffic on that as, just really, really strong engagement. It wasn't something that I think the paper really set out to do, you know, but the editorial stance is what it is on that page. And when you collect it into a powerful sort of set of editorials, it did really well. Now, we also heard from the other side, you know, there are plenty of pro-Trump supporters in California, which makes for a pretty lively dialogue out there. So I think the LA Times right now is in really good position given the marketplace out there.
It's a really weird symbiotic relationship, isn't it, between a president who hates the media,
yeah,
who's bolstering the media.
Right.
I mean, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times may actually owe a debt of gratitude at some point to Donald Trump and his presidency to sort of buoy their financials.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the question is, does it go beyond this presidency, right? I mean, does the momentum continue after he's out of office? We'd like to think so, just because of some of the things that we're seeing. You know, I think in the case of all newspapers right now, we have a much better handle on who is reading us, how they're picking us up, what really drives a reader from being just a sort of a casual reader to one that actually converts into a paid reader. That's really important data to have. It doesn't drive how you cover things, but it certainly guides you on understanding your reader in a much better way.
We really can't talk about Washington, D.C. coverage and the Trump administration and the media without talking about fake news.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of how the president has used this term to characterize coverage he apparently doesn't like?
Just from somebody who oversees a newsroom, it's been, you know, it's fairly distressing when you have the most powerful person in the world really kind of lumping together this notion of fake news, which is a real problem and is obviously is playing a key element in what's being investigated in Washington. When you lump the traditional media, the mainstream, and you know, media into that, it's part of the noise. And for those who are not really paying attention, it becomes a bit of a negative a pall over the industry. Now, you've seen some, you know, both the New York Times and the Washington Post and even the LA Times to a smaller scale counter that with, you know, the Washington Post with their new tagline, "Democracy mm-hmm. dies in darkness." New York Times spending a lot of money on advertising, especially over the award season. I think collectively as an industry, we have to do a better job countering that kind of rhetoric, just because I think it hurts us all.
It's distressing for a number of reasons, but newspapers and reporters strive for accuracy. I mean, that's what we're trained to do, right?
Exactly.
And when we make a mistake, it's like, oh my God, now we got to go back and do a correction, and people are not going to believe the story at all, and all of this.
Right.
Is there a renewed effort of any sort at the papers you've been associated with to make sure that all the facts are right, so the term fake news can't be easily used to describe an article? Or are you just doing what you've always done?
No, I think you hit on something, and it's something we've talked about at the LA Times, and I'm sure it's happening in other newsrooms, is really kind of a renewed effort to make sure that, we are accurate, that is the number one goal. You do not, you know, especially in this era, want to give one side or another a reason to point a finger at you, if at all possible. It's happening on a daily basis anyway. So yes, we, you know, and it comes at a time when obviously resources in the newsroom are strained. You don't have as many safety nets as you used to have, but it is something we talk about with our public editor. There's been a sort of a renewed, I would just say, just heightened awareness of it.
So is the LA Times a local paper, a California paper? Are those terms irrelevant when considering the paper's digital presence?
There are a lot of things that happen in California that become part of the ecosystem in the United States.
You know, I mean, it's almost its own nation state.
You know, it's the sixth largest economy in the world. California is, and so what we've tried to do is really we cover national and foreign events through sort of this California lens, and it's, you know, working on those issues that are really focusing, doubling down on those issues that are really important to people in California. Which means covering, when we're our foreign reporting staff is really covering things that are important, like immigration. You know, we view Mexico, Central America, as our, you know, coverage area. We want to own that. We want to own Asia Pacific. Just because of the diversity of LA. And then from a California standpoint, it is really those issues we think are extremely important, and they become important to the rest of the nation. So I think if you focus on what's happening in your community and in your backyard, importantly, and California is a unique state in that it is so large, that we become this sort of national voice just by default.
That's Jim Kirk. He's a 1987 Illinois State grad and editor-in-chief at the Los Angeles Times. He's back in Bloomington Normal as he's being named to the Vedette Hall of Fame. We touched on the financial struggles facing print media. There was more going on at the Los Angeles Times in the newsroom, which certainly didn't help the paper's competitiveness. When you were called upon to step in, what was the state of the newsroom and why?
You know, I think there had been a history of a lack of communication in the newsroom, which led to some dissent over the past few years. And, you know, another new editor came in recently and didn't mesh well with the staff. So when I came back in January, you know, things were, you know, pretty tough, I'd say. You know, the newsroom had just voted to unionize. There was a bad relationship between the editor and the staff. There was a lot of distrust between both sides. So I would say there was a lot of distraction and morale was pretty low. So the first order of business, I really got off the plane. I called a newsroom-wide meeting and I took questions for 50 minutes. Just let people vent, listen to them. You know, I didn't have all the answers on day one, but you know, and then proceeded to make sure that I was in the newsroom a lot, talking to people, trying to re-engage and focus on the work at hand.
There was newsroom anger over how your predecessor handled coverage of Disney and its relationship with the city of Anaheim. Mm-hmm. Have you reviewed that reporting and talked with the reporters?
Yeah, and, you know, I actually, when I was interim editor, I was part of that editing of that series. So I had obviously had no problem with the series.
There's been no retraction.
No retraction. And, you know, I've been, you know, told the reporters and the editor, the story was, solid and terrific and, the type of reporting that we should do. And reiterated that actually again with the staff as part of introducing the new ownership last week, you know, that was one of the stories I highlighted as some of the great work we've done in the past several months.
In an article about you taking over as editor-in-chief, the LA Times cited analysts who said unifying the newsroom will be key to your and the newspaper's success. Yeah. How do you do that? And what have you accomplished in the last 3 months?
You know, I think obviously you have to have the newsroom in step as much as possible with aligned with the goals. And so, you know, I think the first order of business was really just trying to settle things down and you know, trying to get the staff really to realize that we are all in this together. And, you know, it had been a tough union fight. I addressed that issue head on. I'd been, you know, on the management side, you know, so I had to sort of tell the staff what the management point of view was on unionization and why we felt it was better without a union. You know, so that was a tough period. I addressed that head on with the staff and said, look, we have we have a union now. The goal is to try to find the best contract that we can that works for both sides, and again, just work together on being the best paper that we can. Even despite all the distractions and everything that over the past several months and years, this is a newsroom that continues to pump out great, great work. And I mean, not even the work that, you know, the investigations that take months, really the daily beat reporting. I've been impressed with how much great enterprise work comes off of just the daily beats there and continues to do so.
Part of the problems plaguing the Times were workplace misconduct allegations and sexual harassment lawsuits involving the Los Angeles Times publisher CEO Ross Levinson. And it didn't help that Louis Dvorkin and the editor-in-chief you replaced had a business relationship. What's it like managing a newsroom in the Me Too era?
we were obviously in the center of it from a coverage standpoint, you know, and broke some great stories on some Hollywood misconduct. Did some really good reporting on James Toback, which others had followed after that. You know, I was asked a question myself in the newsroom by one of the top columnists, you know, whether I'd ever had a sexual harassment claim against me. I hadn't. And, you know,
that generated applause, which is sort of sad, really, right?
But, you know, just reiterate that, you know, there is zero tolerance anywhere for that. And, you know, in newsrooms, when you're covering that issue on a daily basis in the news, you know, just make sure that we you know, if there are any issues like that, that they are dealt with head on and as swiftly as possible.
You've said you're not at the LA Times to watch it shrink, but will the newsroom have to shrink more before it can grow again? Where are you in terms of the number of reporters you have and the strength the newsroom has to have to do what it needs to do?
You know, the new owner, Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong, soon to be owner, I should say, the deal has not yet closed, but he has stated publicly and again with the staff last week that, you know, look, he's here. He sees this as wanting to save the paper and you know, make it thrive well into the future. And he sees this as a purchase for his family that goes beyond this generation into the next generation, saying the right things about, you know, really investing in the journalism, which you have to do. I mean, I think you look at the Washington Post and what Jeff Bezos has done, just, you know, by injecting money for more resources, not only on the reporting side, but and this is something that isn't talked about a lot, but really on the technology side, on the platform and analytics and data. So really understanding your reader in a way that we haven't done in the past is really key, and so far the new owner is talking that game, which is music, I think, to everybody's ears.
So, and you're not at a critical point where stories go unreported, or that you're sort of in this point where the paper is losing credibility because you just can't cover everything that needs to be. I mean, you can never cover everything, right?
Yeah.
But are you comfortable with the newsroom staffing levels that you're doing an adequate job of covering California and Washington and the stories that need to be covered?
Yeah, so I would say on that one, we're not like some newspapers that are missing huge, you know, where big government agencies aren't being covered. We're certainly, you know, we're still a significant size newsroom. However, what I will say is that, you know, we've had to shrink like other newsrooms. And the problem with that, we still, you know, the appetite is still the same. You know, you're still trying to cover what you covered before with fewer people. And the problem with trying to cover everything is that you can only then go, you know, an inch deep and you're a mile wide. The things that we won't do going forward are just as important as the things that we will do. So that we are clear about what we really want to focus on. And I think that's true for every newsroom in the country.
Jim Kirk is a 1987 Illinois State University graduate and the editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Times. He's back in Bloomington Normal, being named to the Vedette Hall of Fame. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. What's the future of the print edition of not only the LA Times, but of most newspapers? Are we going to continue to have a paper newspaper on our doorsteps?
All markets are different, right? So you have different types of readership, and, you know, the readership and print readership in Chicago is different than the print readership in San Francisco and LA and Boston. So it's going to be different for each market. I do think at some point you will see probably, and we've seen this in other markets, where, you know, some days of the week probably there won't be a published paper. That's not going to happen in LA or Chicago anytime soon. But in some markets, you're going to start seeing more of that. It's you know, people forget that the largest expense really isn't your newsroom. It's printing and
distributing
that paper on a daily basis, getting it to the porch or to the driveway. And, you know, you and I've seen it. You probably see on campus here, you know, there's a generation of people who are reading news but have never picked up a newspaper. And those trends will continue. When you know, print finally goes away, it's anybody's guess at this point.
When you talk about a digital subscription, are we talking about a PDF version of sorts of a print newspaper, mm-hmm. or are we talking about just a website, or both?
You know, I think when I talk about digital, it's really about the phone. You know, it's the most personal technology. It's where people really, you know, kind of run their lives through their phone on a daily basis. And so, when we work with the with our digital team at the LA Times, even at the Sun Times before that, we were really focused on how is that content going to be accessed on the phone. And it's different than how it's accessed on a desktop or a laptop. So that's where we are focusing a lot of our energy. Now, there is a sizable audience for what we call the e-paper, which is really the replica of the printed paper. And I'd say that group has sort of been in the middle. You know, they're younger readers who kind of grew up with a newspaper but love the fact that they can read on their tablet or on their phone in the same format and the same curation that we give them in print.
Los Angeles Times editor-in-chief and Illinois State University graduate Jim Kirk talking with GLT's Mike McCurdy. Kirk was inducted into the Vedette Hall of Fame on Saturday, a recognition for former students who worked at the campus newspaper. Kirk also addressed a controversy over non-reporters contributing online content, possibly blurring the line between news and advertising. Kirk says there's no strategy for a second newsroom writing for the web. Also inducted into the Vedette Hall of Fame was GLT correspondent and former Pantograph sports editor Brian Bloodworth.
Support for GLT comes from Mid-Illini Credit Union, serving McLean County families since 1940. More information about new certificate deposit rates for 2018 available by calling 309-661-1166 or by visiting MidIlliniCU.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a look back at Carl Castle, his life as rendered by him, and Willis Kern in a 2009 interview. Two community leaders who got a peek behind the Rivian curtain say they returned from Michigan more optimistic about the EV startup's future. Normal Town Council member R.C. McBride and Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel were both on Monday's trip. The Bloomington Normal delegation visited Rivian's vehicle and engineering facility outside Detroit. The visitors included representatives from several of the local governments that approved tax breaks for the electric vehicle startup when it purchased the shuttered Mitsubishi Motors plant in Normal. The stealthy startup hasn't said much publicly about its vehicles. The first one will be a 5-passenger truck introduced in 2020, followed by a 7-passenger SUV. As a matter of disclosure, McBride is also GLT's general manager. He says the visitors got to meet Rivian's leadership team.
RJ spent a lot of time with the group, probably spoke to us for about an hour and a half about not only Rivian's future, but what he and the company foresee as the evolution of how we use transport and automobiles over the next several decades.
So what kind of facility was it? What did the physical spaces look like?
It is, in many ways, it's an office space and a planning space. We spent most of our time in a conference room that is connected to the other Rivian facilities in California and as well as in Normal. But they have a lot of engineers there. They have modeling that's going on there. So it had a very industrial feel, but it was overall very impressive. And there were a lot of people who were very, very busy. I mean, you could feel an energy there.
Yeah, so how did your perceptions of the company evolve from Sunday before you went on the trip to Monday night when you got back?
I probably would have classified myself as a cautious believer in what Rivian is trying to do. And of course, I mean, I have to think that at this point, just about everybody in the community is certainly rooting for Rivian's success. There is a straight line between their success and some additional success for the Bloomington Normal McLean County community. But seeing it certainly changed my perspective. I am much more optimistic and, frankly, more excited about what they're going to be able to bring to our community in coming years.
During a February town council meeting, you said it would be nice if at some point Rivian were to provide a more public update to its local investors, the taxing bodies, essentially, that gave the company tax breaks. Do you still want to see something else beyond the scope of this trip you took?
I think that was – I think yesterday's trip was part of that, right? But again, it's only a select group of people, one or two representatives from the various taxing bodies. And I actually told them, look, I understand the need for stealth mode. I understand that this is a hyper-competitive environment and a hyper-competitive industry, probably to the point that most of us really don't understand just how competitive it is. However, I think you can inform the community, let them know there's momentum, let them know that there's progress without necessarily getting too specific. And I believe we're getting very close to that. I know that there have been more Rivian folks on the ground in our community over the last several months, going to events, building relationships, having meetings with potential stakeholders and partners. So I think that's part of it. But I do think that is going to improve, and I really hope it does improve. But finding that balance, I get it. It can be tough.
And did RJ speak at all to the competitive nature of the EV business? And we've seen other EV startups that have sort of fizzled out, even Tesla. I mean, they're sort of the giant in the room. They've struggled to hit their production promises. Did he talk about the industry in general?
He did talk about the space, and he talked a lot about looking for open spaces within the space, which I thought was very interesting. Tesla is probably the best known name in this area, and I don't think it's any surprise anybody's paying attention. They know that Tesla's had some well-publicized problems of late. They didn't necessarily get into that, but what they did and what helped clarify for me is the fact that they do have a clear idea of where they want to be in this market space and how they can differentiate themselves from others who are on the surface trying to do the same thing.
Did you get to see any vehicles while you're there?
No.
What was the length of the non-disclosure agreement you had to sign?
It was only a few pages. No, I say that because I was trying to say we never did see an actual vehicle. I mean, we did see some models. We saw a lot of mock-ups. I saw some virtual reality things that were pretty cool, and I don't think I'm saying or disseminating anything I should when I see that. But I will just say that they are further along than I had imagined they would be.
RC, anything else you want to add here about the trip?
The thing that I found most intriguing is, and they brought a number of folks in, a number of different people from the leadership team to talk to us, but the thing that I thought was most interesting was the fact that you had this group of people all speaking the same language as far as what their horizon is. And they're not talking about what this industry or what the world's going to look like a year from now or 2 years from now or 5 years from now. They're talking in terms of 10, 20, 30 years, talking generationally. To me, that's exciting. I don't know that American business does that enough. Seems we all live and die on what the stock market does on any given day. So to hear them talking big picture was very exciting.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. That was R.C. McBride, a member of the Normal Town Council. He's also the general manager here at GLT. Also on the Rivian trip were representatives from State Farm, Illinois State and Illinois Wesleyan, the Economic Development Council, and the McLean County Chamber of Commerce, among others. Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel was there too.
I thought it was an excellent visit. Certainly opened our eyes to their progress, and looking forward to see what's going to happen, and hopefully cars start rolling off in 2020.
Mark, what did it physically look like?
Seeing it in person certainly brought it to life, and seeing the number of people they're employing, the fact not only just there in Livonia, but near Detroit, but also on the West Coast, a couple other sites, and then 38 plus employees here down in Bloomington. So it's not a facade; it's happening. So it's just a matter of how fortunate they will they be when they launch, and looking forward to seeing that time.
Well, Rivian has its manufacturing plant in Normal and more staff in California. It's the vehicle and engineering team in Michigan, right?
It's really interesting seeing both sides working together. You have the engineering side, and then you have the research and design side, as they're in very much a millennial type of work environment, very open concept, people working side by side, able to flow across from one side of the building to another side of the building so they can immediately start asking questions. Okay, that might be research and design. How's that impact engineering? And then how's that impact actually as you start laying out production? So really advanced, I would say advanced software being used, some virtual work. And then, of course, what we've been trying to do even down here, as we look at our whole virtual platform, how do we bring real world to our classroom? It's good to see, you know, they're having to bring in four different locations, making sure that communication is happening. So our, you know, as a school person, I'm thinking, wow, how can we bring that into our classrooms and expose our kids to that and have our teachers connect and all the project-based learning type things that are just now at the tip of our fingers.
My understanding is you didn't actually see a vehicle, right? Just some models and mock-ups?
Yes, and a lot of their work, again, this is continuously being revised and updated based on their what they'll be trying to do with their brand and so forth. So we did see that. We didn't actually drive in one of the cars. But again, they've been doing those things. They're ready to, I think, maybe, hopefully, again, I'm hearing 2020, we'll actually see cars rolling out of the plant here at Bloomington Normal.
Mark, how did your perceptions about Rivian change from before the trip to after?
I'm always curious how much of a commitment they'll have to local economy, local business, local school systems, and school systems being the pre-K through 12, but also your higher ed. And I will tell you, I went in there cautiously, and I left thinking they are committed and they're wanting to move forward and make the connections. So connections to kids in high school, even earlier, with STEM work, connections then with apprenticeships, followed with people who are they're needing electricians and so forth. I'll just use that as an example. But that follow-through is starting to happen, and we're looking forward to that. You know, my big push has always been how can we have more real life in our classrooms and make the standards come to life? Well, they're very interested in that as well, with their remote classes, teacher training, job shadowing, those types of things. And we now become very much, how do we design our curriculum, which we have a multitude of curriculum and programs, but how do you align that so you're creating these kinds of thinkers and opening doors for every kid? It doesn't have to be a kid who's going to four-year school. Upon graduation, four-year university, it could be the student who's going right into the workforce, and they need those folks as well. So, yeah, very exciting listening to the plant manager talking about his needs and, you know, how we can hopefully be part of that solution.
That's Mark Daniel, superintendent of Unit 5 Schools, one of several local representatives who traveled this week to Rivian's facility in Michigan. I'm Ryan Denham.
The Rivian plant in Normal will host a hackathon for nonprofits on May 4th through the 6th. It's part of the National 48 and 48 organization, in which local tech and marketing experts build websites for nonprofits in 48 hours. Rivian will host the local event in partnership with the United Way of McLean County and State Farm.
There are stories you hear on GLT that stick with you. You know the ones. Stories and interviews that keep you in your car or make you late. Hi, I'm Laura Kennedy. You count on reporting that informs and engages you, and sometimes even moves you to act. GLT and NPR can bring you stories that matter because the people who value this service contribute to keep it going. It's time to act. Make a first-time contribution at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the 2018 Gamma Phi Circus Spring Shows at Redbird Arena, Friday, April 20th, and Saturday, April 21st at 7 o'clock. Plus a 1 o'clock Saturday matinee featuring a children's carnival starting at noon. Tickets at Redbird Arena Ticket Office, goredbirds.com, or at the door. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, grow. Famed NPR newscaster Carl Castle has died at the age of 84. Castle spent 30 years giving news to NPR listeners during Morning Edition. He was the GLT Radio Faces headliner in 2008, and a few months later announced his retirement from Daily News. GLT's Willis Kern talked with Castle at that time. Castle always joked his alarm was set for 1:05 because he wanted to sleep in.
I don't get up at 1 o'clock. I wake up at 5 after 1 because I want to sleep a little bit longer. Believe me, 5 minutes sometimes can make a big difference.
Prior to joining NPR, Carl, you were a disc jockey, anchor, and news director at local radio stations in the East. How did you wind up at NPR?
Well, I had an acquaintance here, a good friend who worked at NPR, and I was working in Arlington, Virginia, at an all-news operation there. And he called me up one day and said he was looking for a weekend newscaster on this program called All Things Considered, and he would pay me. And I said, well, I can use the money. So I did, and I did part-time work for several months before it was a little bit too much being news director as well as doing this job. It was a little much, and I had to drop out. But in 1977, I found out that the owner was selling our station, and I would be looking for work. So I came back to NPR real fast, hat in hand, and by golly, they had an opening. And so I took it. And I did newscasts for 2 years. We had three newscasts in the morning, 7, 8, and 9 Eastern time. And it was followed by a little short subject thing called a closer look, a little brief news item. So I did that, and then Morning Edition went on the air, and I was in place as a newscaster. Jackie Judd at the time did the top of the hour. I did the bottom of the hour, and when Jackie moved on to CBS a year or so later, then I moved up to the top, and I've been sitting there ever since.
You were on the air when the Iranian hostage crisis occurred in 1979, when the Berlin Wall fell 10 years after that. Yet you say September 11th, 2001 was your most memorable day on the air. Now, beyond those three historic events, what other occurrences, or maybe a single occurrence that you covered, remains most vivid to you?
I think the first time that I had to wait around and be on the air almost immediately. Back in those days, we had Morning Edition and All Things Considered and the newscast within those programs, but nothing between the programs, no newscasts at all. And even overnight, we had no newscasts. So if a big story was to break any time, we would go more or less 24 hours a day with a newscast at the top of the hour. And I was standing there looking at the TV set one morning, and this January morning, I had my overcoat on. I was about ready to leave, mm-hmm. watching the launch of the shuttle go up in the air. And the thing just exploded, as you know. And I began to take my coat off. I knew I'd be on the air in about 15 or 20 minutes, and I was. And it's a case of where you're not making it up, but you're putting it together as you go along. You don't have time to sit down and write because it gets outdated before you can get into the studio. And we were looking for other items to go in there with it. Our research library, which has always been great, gave me some information on an earlier tragedy aboard a shuttle down at Cape Canaveral or Cape Kennedy. And I had that to use, as well as information on my headphones that there would be a statement from the White House, and we'd have that audio momentarily. So things like that, and the attempted assassination of Pope John Paul, we went almost 24 hours, and any story that came along of big importance, we would do. So later on, the question came about, why don't we do this 24 hours every day? And that's what we do now.
Mm-hmm. During your career, you've seen major shifts in the way people get their news, and radio has survived so far anyway. Do you think it will be able to in the years ahead?
Oh, I think so. Radio, you know, was counted out many years ago when television came along, but we survived, and we're still doing fine, probably better than we were back then. Because FM became a big deal after TV came along. And most of the music is on FM, and AM is doing pretty well also. And, of course, we're on most of our stations are FM stations. You can't watch TV while you're driving your car. You got to depend on your radio. So it's going to be around. I think there's still a big future for radio.
Earlier in your career, Carl, you gave an unknown intern named Katie Couric one of her first jobs, yet she was turned down a couple of times to get on at NPR. What did you see in her in those early days that made you think she had a bright future?
She was a delightful, and she still is a delightful individual. She came looking for an internship because she is from Northern Virginia. Her home was nearby. And she attended the University of Virginia, studied journalism there. And she worked with us during the summer of 1976 and was a big, big help. And her personality just kind of captivated people around there. And she went back to school and came back in November to help us the week of the election in which Jimmy Carter was elected president. And I saw Katie from time to time after that. I was at NPR one time when she came in to, she was looking for a job, and we had nothing. And she came back a little later looking for a job, and we had nothing. She did get an internship with, I think, ABC TV. And then I heard that she got a job at CNN. They had studios here in Washington. And I thought it was great, you know, nobody, she'd never been on camera, never been on a microphone. But one day I was looking up at the TV set in our newsroom, and by golly, there's Katie Couric reporting. And from there, she came to Channel 4 here in Washington, the NBC station, got a job there and did a very fine job covering the Pentagon, so good that NBC took her up to New York, and the rest is history.
Mm-hmm.
She's a good worker, and she's a delightful person to know, really.
What are you going to miss, Carl, most about being on the radio every day?
What am I going to miss? I'm going to early morning hours are the best time to work, as far as I'm concerned, if you can manage to get up early in the morning and be on the air. But the friendship that I've developed with a lot of people during those early morning hours, I'll miss that a lot.
Carl Castle, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for speaking with us. All the best in your semi-retirement, and thanks for all that you've done for so many for so long.
It's been a pleasure, Willis.
Castle spoke with GLT's Willis Kern in 2009. He passed away at the age of 84 from complications from Alzheimer's disease. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There's an almost guaranteed path to success in your yard, and it all hinges on putting just the right plants in. Patrick Murphy has details on this edition of GLT's Grow.
There just aren't enough good things to say about native plants. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field, from the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum, it's Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
Hello, Laura.
Today on GLT's Grow, we're going to go native with ideas for using native plants in your yard and why it's such a good idea. And this is just a heads up for you. The Illinois Prairie Wild Ones actually inspired this idea. They're having a program on Tuesday, the 24th, out at Heartland Community College. They're bringing in Douglas Tallamy, a noted ecologist and author who's going to be talking about creating a living landscape and using natives.
Oh, wonderful.
So natives are really good. So that's free and open to the public. Again, that's on the 24th at 7 out at Heartland Community College. So native plants, can't go wrong there, Murph.
Native plants are really underappreciated still. And the native plant trend, some people believe that it started, myself, I believe it started around the 1970s, but it could have started before.
Really?
But what happened in the 70s? Do you remember when Carter was president and there were gas lines?
Oh, sure.
And I think that that could have been a catalyst. That's an opinion that I happen to agree with.
We started focusing a lot more on the environment.
Yes, that's right. There became some awareness because of that petrol fuel shortage.
Mm-hmm.
And but, you know, there are lots of different points of view and opinions on native. Even the term has...
Is it debatable?
It is debatable.
Okay.
And I'm not saying there's no such thing as a native. I'm the opposite direction from that. But there are some people that believe a native is a true native, and that's the only native. And then there's your nativars. Those are plants that have been improved or domesticated by men and women, but its parent plant was a native plant.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to think about if it's native, is it native to where? Native to where?
That's right. Well, right? See, I always thought native plants meant that they've grown in the United States for thousands of years or something.
Actually, that's pretty close, Laura, because only truly native plants are those that are still growing where they originated.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some flexibility in the term because of that. And in the biology and horticulture circles, because they don't always interconnect. There's sometimes differences of opinion there.
Okay.
But what existed in Eastern North America prior to the arrival of Euros and Vikings and mm-hmm. Chinese people, because there's kind of debates about who got here first, or plants that had an adaptability to a climate or soil over the past several thousand years. And this is a term that Guy Sternberg and Jim Wilson, the authors of the book Landscaping with Native Trees, this is one way that they explain it. And I think that it's pretty neat way to understand it. The difference between natives and adaptables to horticulture people is adaptables are plants that come from somewhere else, but they seem to like it in their new home. And they have something to do with why there are fewer natives, because...
Oh, they forced them out.
They kind of forced them out, but they forced them out by fashion.
They're like the European starlings.
They're a lot like that.
Okay.
And carrier pigeons and things like that. So,
right.
Here in the Midwest and McLean County and on ISU's campus, we should see lots of black gum trees. They were part of the native forest, but they're not really common. They're mm-hmm. still a little bit on the rare side. There are several.
Because they're not fashionable?
They are fashionable. I just think that time that has forgotten them.
Ugh.
And this is a great selling point for native trees. The black gum, among other native trees, is a host to nearly 1,000 other types of life. Okay, compare that to a ginkgo, which is highly sought after. I have them in my own yard, my mm-hmm. own property, more than one. It's a host to zero things that live here. So there are not bugs creating shelter there. There may be the occasional bird nest, but they just don't support the life cycle like a native plant would.
You're listening to GLT's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, native plants in the landscape. Now, I'm sure you have some favorite native plants. Are there some, you know, new ways we can look at using native plants in our yards?
Absolutely. And I've been to landscape seminars, so many and so many different ones in my career. I'm fortunate to have been exposed to that. So I picked up some of this stuff along the way. So If you're listening to me and you've shared some knowledge with me in the past and I don't remember your name, please don't take it personally.
Okay.
But the natives are to be used in our landscape as we see them in nature. That's the best way to do it. Why? Because if they grow that way in nature, they're certainly going to grow that way in your landscape. And the best way for me to explain that or to highlight that is think about how you see plants in nature, not the park where man has picked everything.
Right.
I mean nature. Plants grow in groupings of like kinds. If you see white pines are native. If you see white pines in the forest, you might see native dogwoods near them because they like the company of other trees.
Oh.
So that can be arranged that way in the landscape, still have a highly manicured look and be very low maintenance compared to a landscape made of primarily adaptable visiting plants.
Okay.
Right?
And goodness knows that we want to be able to plant things that aren't going to get really thirsty in the middle of July, and they're going to be able to withstand, you know, our summers here. So what are some good ideas for smaller plants that we can incorporate?
For bedding plants that are on the native side, there are a group called forbs, and they are broadleaf plants that grow in the woods that
Ooh,
have flowers.
Cool.
So you got your trillium, your May apple, and others, bluebells, right?
Yes.
So they're not technically a forb, but they're plants that grow in big masses. And when you have them, you would definitely love them because they're a space holder until it's time to start mowing the grass.
Yes.
And then when it starts to get hot and you're mowing the grass less and there's less of green excitement in your lawn, it still exists with these forbs because they're kind of at the end of their cycle during that period. And then they disappear and they come back. But the grasses that are available in the prairie palettes of native plants for any region are really noteworthy. Grasses are awesome because they can accommodate swings in environment. So you have drought periods, and the grasses in the landscape seem to weather it quite well. And I mentioned that drought and extreme thing. The adaptables are not as well suited for the big changes in the landscape mm-hmm. that are related to weather, climate, and things like that. The natives, that's why they're native. They can take those extremes. You know, man's life is short, and we live here, and we see the plants change over the years of our lives, and we think that's it, you know. And by that time, we've wasted half of a lifetime mowing and trimming and all that stuff. And if we would have all had native landscapes, I think we would have found another hobby. It would have been a lot easier to take care of. But I think some people's preference and taste take them to the adaptable stuff and the really formalized landscapes, which are more challenging to do with the native plants.
So do you have a favorite native that you would like people to try?
My favorite native tree is the alder.
The alder.
The alder, the black alder, the common alder. And that's its common name. It's kind of like a fruit salad where there is always something there. There's all
all year long.
Has some surprises all the time,
cool.
Even in the winter when the leaves are gone. I'm a big fan of those. And at the science lab building here on ISU's campus, we have a new landscape that has some coral berry, which is a woodland native shrub. And beautiful flowers, hard to get. That's the second one of my favorites for the natives.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for those ideas, Murph. Do appreciate it.
You're welcome. Next week,
we've got a question from Texas about using prairie verbena in the landscape.
All right.
The stars at night are big and bright, aren't
they?
Now, we'd love to hear from you. Send your questions to WGLT.org/grow.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Thanks as well to Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, and Mike McCurdy for today's show. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.